Thank you, and welcome to the Bank of America Technology Conference. We're delighted. I see a lot of familiar faces. Glad you're all back here this year. I'm Wamsi Mohan. For those I've not met, I'm the tech hardware and supply chain analyst here at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. We're delighted to have IBM here with us today. Martin Schroeter, second time that he is joining our conference. He's the SVP Global Markets, which basically means he runs all of IBM sales, and that is a tremendous job, to say the least. And so we're delighted to have Martin. Martin, you might all know Martin actually from his prior role as CFO for 4 years at IBM. And now, because he's obviously got a different role, different viewpoint of the organization. I also want to mention we have Patricia Murphy and Eric Smit from IR at the back of the room currently. And if you have questions, Eric's up here. And if you've got questions, feel free to also follow up after this. But Martin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
For joining us.
I had a few questions for Patricia and Eric, so maybe I'll just start there.
So to start off, maybe we can kick it off with the macro environment.
Sure.
The macro has been very shaky in some ways, and there's constant news every day in terms of trade, in terms of China. So can you just talk about, in your role, obviously, on a day-to-day basis, you see a lot of what's going on. Would love your perspective on it.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks, everyone, for joining, and thanks for the opportunity to be here as well. Look, I do spend a lot of time with our clients. And when you think about our clients, we run and are part of the biggest banking infrastructures and the airline reservation systems and the supply chains of the world. And so when I look at, let's say, if we go back to first quarter, we'll start there on macro, because I think there are a few points to be made on macro. If we go back to the first quarter, the nature of our discussions with our clients has not changed dramatically. So we are, if I oversimplify our business, we're in two businesses. We deliver productivity to our client base, and then they reinvest that in order to drive new capabilities and new ways of reaching their clients. And that mix, maybe it's 50-50, maybe it's 51-49, 49-51, that doesn't change a lot. And in fact, when you look at our first quarter, one indicator of sort of how they're thinking long term, we saw really good growth in our cloud and our cognitive businesses, right? And that's primarily a software business focused on helping our clients generate new ways of reaching clients, of their clients, of new insights about new ways of working for them. So we saw really good performance there. And I think part of my interpretation is that they've been, they're thinking about the future, forward-looking, continuing to invest in order to position their businesses. We saw really good growth in our GBS business, particularly in consulting. Again, to me, that says they are, and we know they are because we're talking with them. They're looking at how do they change the way they work? How do they digitize their processes, as an example? How do they take where they are today with our cloud and cognitive software, put something together that allows them to become a cognitive enterprise? All very much part of a longer-term journey. So we saw, again, good reinvestment, good growth in those two parts of the business. On the global technology services side of the business, which is very much about delivering productivity to our clients, right? They have these big infrastructures. We run them as a service for them. And that business is always about delivering productivity, which, as I mentioned earlier, they go and reinvest. That business continued to deliver productivity. Now, we've shifted our focus in that business. We've come out of some of the lower margin offerings and elements of that. So that business didn't grow, but it's a stable kind of a business, and there is opportunity out there, but we want to make sure it's good, high-value opportunity. So I would say, again, in the macro side, in the nature of the discussions we're having, that mix between help me drive productivity and then I can reinvest is about what we've seen over the past 18 months. Now, I read the same papers as you do, and so you know we do read about. There's a fair bit of uncertainty. There's a fair bit of what's next. But again, from an investment and a mixed perspective, our clients seem to be continuing to invest because they know that the opportunity they have to become cognitive businesses, the opportunity they have to serve their clients in new ways with new tools, new technologies, is not going to last forever, right? They do have to continue to invest if they want to be competitive, and that's, again, part of the reason they come to us. We know where they are, and we know where they're going. So the investment cycle stays. What else on macro? We'll see. Since we announced our earnings, our first quarter earnings back in April, we've seen the dollar strengthened a little bit more. Right, it was like a 2.5 point impact back when we announced. Now we're up to a 3 point impact based on where the dollar is. So that I think says something more about investment flows around the world than it does about where our clients are necessarily behaving. Those kinds of moves I don't expect are going to change dramatically our clients' investment patterns, but we'll have to watch. We'll have to watch and see what happens. And then there's a lot of talk, a lot of news around trade, right? And that's been primarily around traded goods and how the administrations of our country, other countries are interacting. But again, we'll see how all of that creates obviously uncertainty, and businesses don't tend to love uncertainty, right? They tend to. So we'll have to see what the reaction is.
Yeah. I think in your Q1 call, you also spoke about Asia-Pac being slightly weaker. Is that something that it was, you think, macro-driven at that point? And I think that there was some level of confidence in these were not really, there was a lot to do with timing of certain things rather than true structural demand changes.
Yeah, and I think I still feel that way. So we did have a few things in Asia that kind of slipped out a bit. Because of the role we play in our clients' environments, not every decision is going to line up well with a 90-day reporting period, right? So the things that have now that sort of slipped over, they're closed. So I wouldn't say I wouldn't read it through as a different macro environment, but we do have to recognize that the role we play, the things we need to deliver to our clients, they just take time. And I can tell you as the person who runs sales that I was in those deals and I know that they've now closed. So I would not read through differently from that experience. But it does say a lot about the two businesses we're in, which is, we need to deliver productivity and we also need to give them new function, new capability to go reinvent their businesses. And that was that conversation is global. That's no different in Asia than it is in the U.S.
So Ginny talks a lot about Chapter 2, and when you look at IBM's role in driving digital transformation, how do you approach clients and help them understand the value that IBM brings in changing their environments, how they should think about investing for the future?
Yeah, it is sort of the kind of top of mind for our client base. And I think, based on my discussions, what our clients value very highly from us are a few things. One, we bring them technology, right? So we're still builders of things, right? A big part of our credibility is the research we do. We build things. We understand the technologies because we are building them. So we're bringing them a whole new series of technologies that can help transform their business, and they appreciate that. Blockchain is a good example, right? We're going to fundamentally redefine how safe the food supply is by building the food trust with our clients. We're going to change the way the shipping industry works by building blockchain for trade. So they appreciate that we created that blockchain technology, we put it out into open source, so we have a lot of credibility in technology. I think that's a big part of why, of how we differentiate ourselves and what they're looking.
I think you still have the highest patent count for US companies.
I think we do, touch wood, I think we do. So we bring technology. Secondly, And importantly, you know this, but I think we've talked about this in the past, IBM has always sort of, we're at the intersection of technology and business. So it's one thing to have technology, it's another actually to put it to work. And so we show up with experts who understand their business processes and their workflows, and we can help them actually take these technologies and embed them in their workflows in a way that makes a lot of sense for them, and in a way that sort of represents how their industry can behave, because we do organize ourselves very much on an industry context, and we have deep, deep industry insights. So bringing technology helps helps a ton, and bringing the know-how that allows them to implement it so they can actually use it is, I think, sort of the other part that they're looking at us for. Now, the other thing I'd add is that we can also they trust us, right? There's probably a lot of ways to say that, but they do trust us.
Yes.
They trust us because they trust our technologies. They trust us because we introduce technologies in a very responsible way. They trust us because we understand their industry. And they trust us for another really important reason, which is they understand our business model, and we're not competing with them, mm-hmm. right? So when you look at the long arc journeys they're on, whether that's moving to a hybrid cloud to get new AI capabilities or moving to a hybrid cloud to get better agility, they trust that we're not going to compete with them, so we have a whole different discussion around their data, who owns their data, because they know they own it with us. They know that they own their insights. So in addition, again, we bring them technology that both we develop, but we bring other technologies into the picture. We have a set of, we have expertise around their industry and around their particular workflows. And then this element of trust is so, so important today. Every one of our clients, every company in the world is thinking about how do I start to head down this journey, and how do I pick, you know, if I had to just pick one, or if I'm only going to pick a handful, how do I pick a technology provider and an integrator who isn't going to sort of undermine me, try to intermediate me from my own clients? Those are really important decisions, really important discussions, and I think that's why we're in a lot of these discussions. We bring technology, we bring the expertise to implement it, and they trust us.
Yeah, as a firm, Bank of America has been writing about migration to the cloud for a long time. And the changes that we have observed is that there was a big impetus about everything moving to public cloud. I think that was a theory that was there maybe even 10 years ago. I think you guys have been very steadfast in saying there's going to be a hybrid cloud model. I think you guys were pretty early on saying that's ultimately where things will go in terms of architecture. When you look at the amount of CapEx that the large public cloud guys are putting in, that's, you know, fairly significant, still growing at a decent pace. Your cloud business has become fairly significant, about $20 billion of cloud revenue for you. But when you think about how the journey of these customers is evolving into this hybrid cloud model, and you're seeing some evidence even from the public cloud guys on trying to do things on-prem now, how do you see this playing out in the next few years?
Wow, that's a lot there. There's a lot there. So let's spend a few minutes, I think, first on, you know, kind of where we are in the state of play in the cloud world. Every discussion is about a cloud, whether that's going to ultimately wind up in public, whether that is going to stay on-prem, whether that is in a private cloud. I mean, the discussion is about hybrid. Because that's the world in which we're all going to live. That's the world we live in today, and that's the world that's going to stay. And in fact, as you said, you know, we've always said hybrid, right? So there was some noise talk about this idea that everything's going to move to a cloud. But we're almost 20 years in, almost, right? And fewer than 20% of the things have moved to the cloud. So it's the cloud is here. It's real. Everyone's thinking about it. But even if you look today at the state of play, most of our clients already have 5 or 6 clouds. So this idea that everything's going to move to a public cloud is just, we never thought that was viable. We didn't form that opinion any other way than talking to our clients, right? All the banks, all their airlines, all the supply chains, as I mentioned earlier. So in that world, that's state of play today. What's one reason that it sort of sits at that high teens kind of a level? Well, look, the things that are going to be the next push are going to be the much more kind of mission-critical things. Because just because it's mission-critical doesn't mean you don't want agility, doesn't mean you don't want flexibility, doesn't mean you don't want to embed and use your data in better ways to make those processes run better. So when you start to talk about mission-critical, though, now you start to talk about, you know, how enterprises really run. You need scale. You need a whole new, probably a whole new thought about security and your data and how you're dismantling those applications. So in this phase, the next phase, if you will, you know, some things obviously are going to stay on prem, as you said. A lot of our clients are building private clouds, and they continue as they have. They build private clouds because you get all the agility, and there's no additional economics, if you will, from going to public. And particularly if you're in a regulated industry, private makes a lot of sense because you can navigate a regulated environment in a private cloud while getting agility. You do have to refactor your applications, right? You do have to put them to cloudify them, if you will. I don't think that's a word, but you do have to get them to work in a private cloud. But that's work that we help our clients do today. So in that world, the world is going to have some things continue to move to public. The world is going to have some things sit private, some things sit on-prem. And our view has always been that that's the world in which we have to operate and help our clients. Now, in that world, how you manage across all these clouds becomes really important, right? We can do that for our clients because we've said in this open hybrid cloud world, a provider like IBM needs to be able to manage across, right? Having these little pools of data in places and having these sort of little one-off applications is not going to help a CIO, manage the data. It's not going to help a CIO feel secure about where their data is and how their applications run. So that's the world. What we're starting to, and that's our view of the world, open, hybrid, you know, multi-cloud, help them achieve that. What some are starting to do are trying to take their proprietary stack and put it into a private cloud environment, but it doesn't really help with what our clients are, the other thing our clients are worried about, which is, look, we can't be locked in, right? We can't be working in a closed environment. I can't build my enterprise. I cannot build my enterprise and all the mission-critical apps in a closed environment where I am locked into a single vendor. So I can't absorb all of these AI tools necessarily unless they're open. I can't build the skills I need if I'm going to work in a proprietary closed environment. So that shift, which we've observed, isn't really solving the big problem that I think our clients have talked to us about, which is, again, the client need to operate in an open world. I need to operate multi-cloud. I need your help, IBM, to help me manage all of that. But just putting another proprietary stack into my environment is not going to be the path. I need management of multi-clouds. And while today it's, you know, five or six in who knows, 5-6 years, it could be 10 or 11, it could be 6 or 7, who knows. But we know it's not one, we know it's going to be multi-cloud. That's what we're helping our clients do. That's the journey they're all on in terms of cloud and how do I get agility.
So maybe that's a good segue to talk about your latest deal, Red Hat, and how, you know, what was the thinking behind Red Hat? Maybe if you could quickly talk about what does it really change for IBM? And then secondarily, like, you know, as basically head of global sales, like, what are you seeing? What are you going to tell your sales folks around how do you go to market? What can you do to make this a very successful transaction?
Yeah, so we'll talk about Red Hat to the extent we can, right? Obviously, we're going still through a regulatory process here, so we're not closed yet. But I'll talk a little bit about, I think, sort of the how our clients are both what they told us, what they're telling us now, right? What they told us before, what they're telling us now. And then to your second question, how do we take help Red Hat now and expand them probably much more rapidly than they necessarily could have on their own. So first, and I touched on this earlier, the agility that our clients want from moving to a cloud, the access to tools, the ability to build and get tools and lots of AI tools, machine learning, all of that is the journey they are on. And it's an important journey. However, what what many of them have said is that, look, I can't afford to take this mission critical stuff and move it into a closed environment. I can't count on tools that aren't open. And by the way, I, Mr. Miss CIO, I want to build skills myself. I want to have a team because I'm in the data business. Forget about if you're in banking or airlines, it doesn't matter, retail, I'm in the data business. I want to build those skills myself, so I want to build them on open tools that I can now go drive an innovation agenda in my firm. The only way I can do that is if I wind up in an open platform. So what Red Hat does, allows us to do now, what IBM and Red Hat together allow us to do, is ensure that we can give them that open stack that allows them to be confident that in those mission critical now, in those mission critical apps as they start to move, that they're not going to get locked in, tied in, and their enterprise will be safe. And importantly, they can become the not self-integrators, but they can build skills themselves, right? You've heard some of my peers in IBM talk a lot about the IBM garage methodology, right? Yes. Where we do come together, we co-create. That is very much the model of how the modern CIO wants to work. In order to do that, you know, they bring their skills, we bring ours, but you need an open environment. Red Hat gives us that open environment. So what we've talked about right from day one, from the day we announced it, Ginny has talked about, you know, let's make sure everyone recognizes Red Hat is, you know, my words, the Switzerland of the operating system world. We will make sure that that stays, right? Mm-hmm. The developer ecosystem they built, which is really powerful. The commitment to open is really powerful. And we've said we're gonna keep that exactly as it is. Now, from a go-to-market perspective on you know, my team out with our clients, the feedback we've gotten is almost, in some ways, it's like a sigh of relief, because now they can look at the other 80%+ of what they're doing and actually give it a really good kind of, put it through a framework that says, now that it's viable for me to think about where I can move these, because now I can go build on an open framework, I can get access to the open, the tools I need to embed machine learning or AI, whatever you want to call it, then now it becomes viable for me to think about that. So our client feedback has been phenomenal. They're excited about that because that allows that journey to continue, whereas before they were kind of holding back for the reason I mentioned. They can't find themselves kind of trapped into a proprietary environment. So we have, you know, we operate in 172 countries. I think that you know, our sales teams are getting all the education they need to be conversant, to be deep technically with our client base on you know, what does that journey look like? How do you modernize your apps? What does the landing place look like? Mm-hmm. How do you make sure that you wind up in a spot you want? So, yes, we're excited about it. I think our clients are very excited about it based on my discussions with them. And it really is this open, hybrid, multi-cloud environment that they need, that they want, that allows that journey to continue.
Where are we in that regulatory process? What are your thoughts on timing on that?
Well, I think we've said we still expect a second half kind of closing, and I think we're still in that same spot, second half. You saw we had, you know, the U.S. went well.
Yes.
So now we're still in that process with those that are open. Second half, I think, is still where we see it.
Right. You mentioned AI. There's been a huge amount of investment that's been made by all the tech giants around AI. You guys have had, you know, Watson in various forms and has evolved, various different business models have come to life, different industry verticals that you've tackled. Where are you with respect to your AI initiatives? How do you frame that with your sales force in the broader context?
Yeah, it's a good question, because it is very much front of mind for our clients, is how do, they're all asking, you know, I need to start down this journey. I know that I need to embed AI into my processes. I need to get there ahead of my competition. I have all this data, kind of please help. That's sort of the first call. The starting point for many of these discussions, by the way, is all the work we do to help our clients get their data organized in a way that allows them to even take advantage of AI. Because in our experts, our AI experts, our software experts have a phrase, it's not my phrase, I'm not saying I don't like the phrase, but they would say, look, there's no AI without IA, there's no artificial intelligence without an information architecture. Mm-hmm. So the initial discussion on a lot of these places is, how do I get my data organized in a way that helps me? Now, once you've started that journey, and I'll come back to IBM in a second, because we're you know, obviously big users of it as well. And you mentioned Watson. When you start that journey and you're using, say, Watson, you're using Watson in its current form, and we'll continue to evolve Watson, but it's a very consumable form, right? So you may call an API to help you build a call center application. You call put a few APIs together to help you build a call center application. That is a very common use, and we're mm-hmm. seeing our clients are seeing tremendous productivity out of embedding AI into call centers so that they can respond to their clients more effectively. So there are a ton of projects sort of heading down that path of the sort of the simple, how do I take my first steps? Again, you need your data in a way, in a structure that's going to allow that. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing in banks that call center application sort of taking off. In healthcare, we're seeing it in helping doctors, right? And essentially leveraging the best knowledge that's available and the best approaches that are available, and getting that into places where it's just not as readily available as it might be in the U.S. Right, so we're seeing it in applications for health and financial services, as I said, in some call center applications, and then we're seeing it deployed in a lot of IoT environments where all this data is coming in a way that they're trying to make sense of. How do you run a railroad? How do you maintain equipment? How do you maintain machinery? So we're seeing it pretty broadly spread. It's not one industry. It's across many, many industries. And we're using it similarly. So we use it in our HR processes. We use it in our supply chain. We're pretty heavy users of AI ourselves. There is one element, and this was not part of your question, but I do want to a little bit of a detour. There's one element of this that our clients are worried about, and we've taken a leadership position on, and I spent time in Washington last week on this topic, and that's what I'll call digital trade. So what all of the AI today needs, and what all of our clients need, is to make sure they can move their data around in a way that allows them to make use of it. This is not like our phone numbers and our addresses. I'm not talking about personal data. But the supply chains of the world work by moving data from place to place. The shipping industry works by to be able to move data. We are seeing pockets of really, really good digital trade laws being included. TPP has pretty good digital trade laws. The USMCA has the best digital trade laws we've seen. The challenge is TPP is only a handful of countries, right? USMCA is us and Mexico, us and Canada. We're not seeing a broad acceptance or a broad sort of framework for how digital trade should occur. And that's what I've been spending time on as well, is making sure that we have a framework that allows that journey for AI to continue by having robust protections, if you will, around how data can move. Japan has, Japan has the seat now in the G20. They're going to use it to go through a WTO process. We're aligned with the Japanese. I met with the Japanese trade minister. I mean, almost like 100% aligned on the kinds of principles. Now we just need to get much, much broader agreement on a set of principles. So I include that in the AI discussion because it's imperative that if we're going to continue this journey, if our clients are going to continue this journey about how to embed AI, we get really good digital trade laws. We get really good digital trade frameworks so that the data can move. Again, this is not a privacy issue. Yeah. It's not about your phone number. It's about how do you move data to run the systems of the world, the banking systems and the reservation systems, the transactional systems of the world. You need good digital trade laws. What you'll pick up the paper and you'll read about are, goods trade, right? They'll talk about soybeans and they'll talk about electronics, yes. But we need digital trade. That's why we're bringing it kind of front of mind for administrations to make sure we get it in there.
No, that's a great point. So it sounds as though digital trade is one of those maybe gating factors in terms of adoption rates for AI. It feels like the adoption rate maybe has not been as fast as what people might have anticipated a few years ago. at least within certain industries. And I wonder if it has to do with some of the digital trade laws. Some of it could be just the data wrangling, getting all that data sort of organized in the right way to be able to mine it and analyze it and derive inferences. So what do you think has created maybe a slower rate of uptake of AI?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't classify it as a slow rate of uptake at all. I do think there are some things that we as an economy have to get through, and as I mentioned earlier, so getting your data in order is really, really important, and that takes a bit of time. Digital trade is an issue that we have to deal with, otherwise it will slow progress, but I wouldn't say it's been an issue to date, but it could become an issue. What I think is the path we're going through, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, the CIO of today wants to co-create. The CIO of today wants to build their own skills in their own organization. So when I sit in an IBM Garage session with us, one of our clients, and we start co-creating, boy, it does not take, Wamsi, it does not take 10 minutes, and you'll have 50 things, 50 ideas on the board from the teams on what they can go do. So that happens very quickly. Then in our garage methodology, we'll have a prototype out. We'll have something out within 2 days, and it'll start to test it, and it'll start to learn. So it's not a shortage of ideas. It's not a shortage of access to technology, but you do have to get your data organized. And then, as I mentioned, the reason I bring up co-creation is because the tools that our co-developers, that our clients need, you need familiarity with those as well. You need to learn how to use them, how to embed them, and so I think we've gone very, very quickly. I think from our experience, what we're delivering for our clients is very, very powerful. As I mentioned, we're in, there's not too many industries in which that we haven't touched. We have thousands and thousands of projects going on. Now, this is the perspective from IBM, which, consultants, the third party consultants would say, well, IBM is the leader, so it's not a surprise that you're hearing them say that we're going pretty fast. I don't know that that's everyone else's experience, but again, they're not the leaders in the industry. So with getting our clients' data in, with helping their teams, their ecosystem, their developer community, and everything, getting that familiarity with the tool sets and how to use and how to think about it, and the ability to rapidly prototype and build, continue to evolve it, that's happening, I'd say, very, very quickly. So there is a lot more in this space. We're early innings, but I think this is, from what our clients tell us, they know it's an imperative. They know they have to head down this path. They are looking for us to help them both with the technology as well as how do I embed it into my process. So it's going, I think it's going really, really well.
When you look at, just to switch gears a little bit into services, you've delivered some tremendous change and margin improvement in GBS. Gross margins have expanded quite significantly. The skill base had been reoriented. There was a lot of hard work I know that went into that, and the fruits of that are sort of showing up now. When you look at GTS, though, in the last call, I think there was some comments around, hey, we're going to be more selective a little bit around GTS. And so how should we think about what you're doing in GTS? Maybe if we can contrast that with what happened in GBS. GBS was a multi-year journey. Is GTS something like that? Is GTS something quick? How should we think about what you're trying to accomplish within GTS? And there was margin improvement there, too.
Yeah, there was margin improvement. I mean, I think what we talked about on our call with regard to GTS and focus is really it's completely consistent with what we've talked about is the IBM financial model, the overall financial model, which is focused on high value. So similarly, when we divested of our x86 server business, we said, look, that's a commoditized place. It's not going to drive the kind of margins we need. It's not highly valued by our clients, so we're going to divest. When we looked across the GTS portfolio, that is a high value business, right? The work we're doing is very high value. But we are going to say no to things like bringing other OEM content into it because there's no value there. So the revenue line will get a little bit of pressure by choices we make. right? But the business itself is a business that delivers a ton of productivity to our clients, so it's very highly valued by them. That business will, you know, once we sort of get the lower margin content out, that business is a business that resonates very, very well. The offerings resonate very, very well with our clients because those offerings now reflect, not dissimilar to what we went through in GBS, those offerings now reflect the world of hybrid multi-cloud. So our backlog is now, you know, which massive backlog, right? Our backlog now is almost a third cloud, right? Now it doesn't turn over quickly because it has a long duration to it. But that's a high value business because now it is basically becoming a cloud business. Yes, we'll get some of the low margin stuff out, but it is a high value business. So the process we use when we talk about the IBM business model is no different when we look at a segment reporting, and that really is about value. What GBS has done similarly is taken the offerings that we're starting to commoditize, and we've talked about this already years ago. We said, look, some of these big enterprise kind of application implementations are commoditizing. So we're going to take those skills, we're going to retrain them, we're going to put them into helping our clients digitize their process, helping our clients with the design they need in order to build more compelling apps for their own use. So we've done that in GBS. We've modernized those offerings, and they now reflect, like as I said, they reflect digital design, they reflect the digital journeys that our clients are on, much, much higher value than where they were. GTS is in that similar process. Again, it's very cloud focused now, highly valued by our clients, but we are going to get the OEM stuff out of the revenue stream. It just doesn't make sense to have it.
We're coming up at the end of time here, Martin, but I just wanted to talk about innovation for a couple of minutes because I feel like IBM is a gigantic organization, and we don't talk about it enough, but I mentioned patents, and you're the leader in patents. I think you've also done a great job in commercializing things so that they can be applicable to business. You see a lot of companies talk about AI, but there is really no monetization path off that AI technology. It's sort of used internally for various purposes. You guys have done a great job commercializing it. So when you look at some of the things down the road, what are the most exciting things that you're seeing down the road for IBM?
Yeah. Look, we've been an innovation machine for a long, long time, right? And when we look out at the world, and our researchers look out at the world, there are, I think, a few that are already here today that are going to define how businesses operate with one another for a long time to come. And again, it is important. This is enterprise, right?
Yes.
This is enterprise tech. It's not consumer.
Yes.
So in the world of enterprise, and I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but blockchain is a very real technology that has a lot of value in the enterprise because of the way it allows parties to trust one another, essentially, right, without an intermediary. So it can add a ton of efficiency. And when we look at how many blockchain projects we have going on in, you know, doing real work, and we use it ourselves also, it is a very exciting technology. Part of the reason that we gave the fabric to the open source community is because Our clients, again, it's not different from the cloud discussion. Our clients were never going to buy into a closed proprietary technology. You have to give them sort of that base on which to build, and that's why we're the leaders in blockchain. It's because we've given them a base, we bring in the expertise that helps them use this innovation, and then obviously we add more value on top of that stack. So blockchain, already today, delivering a ton of value, it has got a long, long runway ahead of it still from a future value. And then the other one I'd point out that I think is very exciting is quantum. Mm. So, you know, we're the builders of quantum systems, right? We're the ones who make it available. You can use our quantum system. There are a lot of people writing white papers on quantum, but writing a white paper and having a quantum system are two different things. And so, you know, we've made ours available. We see the power of what quantum will likely be able to solve, not only today, but as it continues to expand, is really encouraging, and our clients are excited. That's why so many of them have joined our quantum effort, right, to help them think through, all right, how do I use this new kind of technology? But importantly, I think quantum is another example of a technology that, yes, we will introduce it to the world, but we'll introduce it in a very responsible way. Because with quantum, yes, it can be used to build much, much better risk models of in financial services. It can be used to model chemical compounds much, much more efficiently, say, for a pharmaceutical company. It can also break every encryption device that exists today. Not yet, but you know, we're heading down that path. So it needs to be ushered into the world in a responsible way, so that it can be used for the purposes that will advance, advance what people are trying to do, advance society, not turn it into a really, really big mistake. So I'm excited about blockchain. Our clients are excited about blockchain. We're all excited about the AI journey. Again, there's a lot of data work that has to happen, which we're helping our clients with. And we're all excited about quantum when we usher it in a way that's responsible. All of that, however, I think there are two points to be made. The reason we're in these discussions with our clients is because we're still the builders of technology. We have that credibility. And two, we need to make sure we have a robust digital trade framework so that the data can be moved. And data does underpin all those exciting innovations. Can't do it if you can't move the data.
Martin, we're unfortunately out of time. Really appreciate you
Thank
taking
you,
the time today and sharing all these insights.
Thanks, Wamsi. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.